Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Turns out Toyota was right. Also, the Chinese want to stop their economy from going wrong. And some more Freakonomics. This week, it hurts so good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, the 8th of February. Good as always to have you here. And here is your automotive phrase of the day from the government's 10-month study of Toyota and its unintended acceleration problems. Pedal misapplication was one likely cause. Driver stepping on the gas instead of the brake. Safety officials said they found no link between electronic throttles and runaway cars. Out-of-control Toyotas and Lexuses have been blamed for 89 deaths and dozens of accidents. And today, the Transportation Department agreed with Toyota about the cause. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says an exhaustive inspection of Toyotas that suddenly surged forward at high speeds found no electronic cause. Toyota's problems, he said, were mechanical.
Some Toyota floor mats entrapped drivers' gas pedal while their vehicles were in motion. Second, so-called sticky pedals made some Toyota acceleration too slow to release.
The world's largest carmaker recalled 8 million vehicles to fix both problems, but only after being prodded by the National Highway Traffic Safety Commission. The company paid a record $49 million fine for its slow response to thousands of complaints, and it spent $2 billion on the recall and mechanical repairs. Toyota sales in the U.S. and Europe have suffered from the publicity over sudden acceleration. Earlier today, before the government announcement, the company reported a 40% drop in quarterly profits. Some car safety advocates, like former Traffic Safety Commission Administrator Joan Claybrook, are skeptical the government has found the real cause.
There are hundreds of reliable witnesses who experienced this problem. The inquiry did not really place a lot of effort to get their full story.
LaHood says Toyotas are now safe to drive. Still, government safety officials are considering a requirement that all cars have a brake override system, where the brake takes precedence when both it and the accelerator pedal are pushed. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
China tugged hard on its economic reins again today, trying to cool things down. Beijing raised interest rates for the second time in just over 6 weeks. The government's words, stubbornly high inflation, could feed some popular discontent. And the same thing is happening elsewhere. The rising cost of living is part of what's happening in Egypt. And just today, Brazil and Chile reported fresh inflation worries as well. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has more.
Given the economic climate here at home, there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to inflation. If anything, the Federal Reserve has been focused on getting the economy jump-started just about any way it can. Now, some worry the Fed's policies might be adding to global inflationary pressures. Investment strategy researcher Ed Yardeni argues that food, oil, and other prices around the world are being artificially inflated by the flood of U.S. money.
That is certainly encouraging commodity speculators to not only buy these commodities for end users, but also on a speculative basis.
Just last week, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke rejected that idea. He suggested the U.S. has its own troubles to worry about, and other countries can deal with their inflationary issues.
I think it's entirely unfair to attribute excess demand pressures in emerging markets to U.S. monetary policy, because emerging markets have all the tools they need to address excess demand in those countries.
Such as, Bernanke added, adjusting the value of their currency, a not-so-veiled reference to China. Charles Schultz headed President Jimmy Carter's Council of Economic Advisers. He says the U.S. doesn't need to worry about the kind of surging inflation threatening China and other developing countries, but he concedes rising food and energy prices could still be an unwanted drag.
What it does, even if it's not setting off inflation, it does take purchasing power away from U.S. workers, and it could have an effect on consumption, which wouldn't be good.
Although Schultz points out, American consumers have been increasing their spending in spite of those higher prices. Yardeni, on the other hand, suggests a slight rise in interest rates here could help keep prices in check without stifling the recovery. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Seven winners in a row on Wall Street, if you're counting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's time once again for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every 2 weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner. He's the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Kai. We like to start off by giving you a little something, usually. Today, it's not a gift. Today, I brought you something that I sincerely hope never happens to you.
My jaw has a big crack right here, and they put two plates and 12 screws, and it shattered. Like, my bottom five teeth got knocked out. They're like sitting in my throat. I could feel them. And oral surgeon said that it looked like a gunshot wound.
All right. Well, clearly, I guess it wasn't a gunshot wound since the surgeon said it looked like that. Did he get like hit by a bus or something?
Yeah, it sounds like it. But this injury was the result of hockey puck meets face.
Oh.
That was Jack Hillen, who you heard speaking. He's a defenseman for the New York Islanders hockey team. Now, remarkably, just 5 weeks after that injury, Hillen was back out there on the ice playing. And it made me wonder, Kai, when it comes to pain, how can people like you and me kind of tap our inner hockey player?
Well, so here's the thing. One is I'm reasonably tough for a public radio host. I mean, I've got a high pain threshold. But NHL players are you know, probably tougher. And also, they get paid to take the pain. That's the thing.
Those are both true. Here's what I wanted to figure out. When you know something is going to hurt, whether it's a puck to the face or something more abstract, how do you nevertheless get people to do it? So I found one answer, strange as it may seem, in your colon. Not your colon necessarily,
man.
Kai, but in colons in general.
Dude, all right. It's a family show. Just remember that.
We'll keep it clean from here on out.
Right.
I want you to listen to Donald Rettelmeyer, who's a doctor at Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto, who conducted some truly fascinating research on people who were having colonoscopies.
Probably the single most practical thing is to slow down towards the end of the procedure so that you give them a sense of mildness. Those last impressions can be lasting impressions.
One would hope that they would slow down for the entire procedure, not just the very end. But what's he really talking about?
Well, his point is that pain is important, but what's maybe just as important is how people remember pain, how they process it and how they remember it. So what he discovered in this experiment is that people tend to remember the peak moment of pain much more than the average amount of pain. So and that peak moment, how bad it was, informs how people assess the entire experience. Also, because those, as he puts it, those last impressions are lasting impressions, he found that if a doctor just leaves the colonoscopy scope inside the patient for a few extra minutes at the end when it's causing no pain, the patient will later judge that the entire experience is being more pleasant, even though it took longer. And that's really important because a patient with a good memory of a colonoscopy is about 20% more likely to return when they need the next one, which is very significant if you're trying to help people detect colon cancer.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure I buy the whole, you know, longer is better thing, but we'll take that argument at its face. But let me ask you a sort of a transition question here, if I might. This is very real physical pain you're talking about. We on this broadcast talk about abstract pain a lot, and specifically financial pain, right? The president wants to cut the budget. Congress is having conversations about this. States are out of money. Households don't have any money these days. Make that connection for me.
Right. Well, I tried to make the connection. I took what Dr. Rettelmeyer taught us, and I went to Governor O'Malley, Martin O'Malley of Maryland, which is, like a lot of states, facing a big budget gap, $1.4 billion or 10%. So he's got to sell his constituents on the pain of those cutbacks. So I asked Governor O'Malley, you know, I told him about Rettelmeyer's study, and I said, how do you plan to sell this pain?
I've been well advised not to use the word pain and not to use the word painful. Those words cause pain, and those words are painful.
Yeah, so that was like what, four pains and painfuls by a guy who was told not to talk about it?
Which would connote that denial is a very important piece of pain
right.
dishing
That's
strategy.
Right.
But just to show you how much discipline the governor has, when he gave his State of the State address last week, how many times, Kai, do you think he actually did use the word pain?
Yeah, got to be zero, right? He's a politician.
Zero. Very, he was very disciplined. So he's a good politician in that regard. Instead, he told the voters that what they had to expect was, you know, tough choices and difficult decisions, the typical playbook of government euphemism. It's kind of like when your doctor says, you know, come on in, Kai, this won't hurt a bit.
Yeah, as he snaps on the rubber gloves, right? All right, as we say goodbye here, Dubner, just remember this. Those last impressions, they're lasting impressions. So be nice on the way out, will you?
Well, that being the case, Kai, let me just say that I love you, man.
Oh, dude, I love you too. Oh, no, get out of here. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomicsradio.com. He's back in a couple of weeks. See ya.
Okay, Kai, take care.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud.
The actual title of the new Spider-Man musical on Broadway is Turn Off the Dark. But you got to wonder if at this point it should just be Turn It Off, because the show has had way more than its share of problems, postponed openings, serious injuries, countless technical difficulties. And this morning, the New York Times weighed in with its official review. Let's just say words like calamity, cheap-looking, and tedious, confusing tripe took center stage. And that's for a show that's not even open yet. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more.
$65 million have been poured into Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. The show features elaborate sets, complicated wirework, a famous director, and music by Bono. See how the boy falls from the sky. But for most people, Spider-Man the musical has become synonymous with disaster. At TKTS in Times Square, Nick Angelo says he's definitely heard about Spider-Man.
I mean, I heard it was like it would open for one night, someone would die, and then it'd be off for like 2 weeks.
Actually, nobody's died. But the dark rumor mill has played to the show's advantage, says media analyst Porter Bibb.
Check the box office. Spider-Man is book solid and selling out night after night.
Leonard Jacobs agrees. He's the editor of arts publication The Clyde Fitch Report.
I think half of the people that are going want to see if somebody falls another 20 feet and breaks their back.
Jacob says with all of the problems and delays, critics had a right to break with tradition and review Spider-Man before opening night. He says the bad reviews won't hurt sales for now, but could once the morbid curiosity dies down. And Spider-Man would have to play to sold-out houses for an estimated 4 years just to break even. Back in Times Square, Nick Angelo says all of the bad news has intrigued him.
If it's so bad, I would love to go see it and just be like, that was so horrendous. But I guess it all depends on how much money I'm spending to see it.
Spider-Man tickets are among the most expensive on Broadway. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. All righty, so let's see. The Dow Industrials pumped up 71 points today, 0.5%, finished at 12,233. The NASDAQ up 13 points, also 0.5%, 2797 at the bell. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.4%, checked out at 1324. Goldman Sachs rose 0.8%, J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley both climbed more than 0.5%. But Bank of America was down 0.4% today. Citigroup cashed in 0.2%. Good day for retailers, though. Urban Outfitters climbed 5.5%. JCPenney put on 5%. Macy's up 3% today. One of the country's biggest natural gas facilities was rocked by a series of explosions today. Stock in Enterprise Products Partners, the plant owner, lost 0.2%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing partner to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/grow. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Here's a look at the Marketplace State Book for events coming up Wednesday. The House Budget Committee holds a hearing on the state of the U.S. economy. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies. First Lady Michelle Obama talks about her campaign to fight childhood obesity on Live with Regis and Kelly. And the Brooks Brothers coat worn by President Lincoln to Ford's Theater on the night he was assassinated will once again be on display at the theater. It's been in conservation storage. You've got 6 months to glimpse the real deal. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hundreds of thousands of protesters took to the streets in Cairo once again today. It's the biggest reminder so far that the government's offers of reform seem not to be enough. The protests against poverty and corruption and economic disadvantage that started in Tunisia are spreading, as we know, to Jordan most recently, even though King Abdullah has fired the cabinet and promised changes there. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Amman, the capital city. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
What's the sense you get when you're out and about on the streets of Amman?
Well, on the surface, it seems very calm. There have been a lot of protests here, but none of them have been violent. There was a protest here, in fact, today, outside the Egyptian embassy, and the chanting sounded almost gentlemanly. This was a group of engineers, lawyers and doctors and other professional types calling for Mubarak to step down in Egypt. But although it was a pretty low-key affair, one of the people taking part, 38-year-old translator Rifat Odeh, claims that most Jordanians identify very strongly, very keenly with the protesters in Egypt.
Both countries suffer from a lot of corruption. Both countries suffer from severe unemployment. A lot of people live below the poverty line in both countries. And there is no real democracy either here or in Egypt.
Well, they want Mubarak out in Egypt. That much is clear, Stephen. But what do the Jordanian protesters want at home? Do they want the king, King Abdullah, out?
No, they don't. The king is actually very popular here. Many people want him to stay. They just want him to become more democratic and give up some of his control over the government and parliament. They want him to stamp out corruption, too. He's widely seen as the only one who can hold this country together. And this is a very important interest for the U.S. The U.S. has poured $4 billion worth of aid into this country over the past decade in order to hold it together. This is one of only two Arab countries that have signed a peace treaty with Israel. And as economist Yusuf Mansour points out, this is a vital Western ally.
We are friendly to the West. We're like this oasis of stability in a hot region. It is a country you don't want to radicalize.
It sounds vaguely not threatening, Stephen, but certainly dire. Make the regional case for me, the regional economic case.
Well, this is an absolutely critical region for the U.S. because this is where most of the world's exported oil comes from. So it is critical that a vital friend and ally like Jordan doesn't turn into the next Iran. It's highly unlikely this will happen. It's even unlikely this will happen in Egypt. But that is the fear in the back of most people's minds. This is the fourth poorest country in the Arab world, Jordan, on a per capita basis. 26% unemployment among the youth. The fear is that if there is serious unrest here, social cohesion could break down, Jordan could turn hostile, and the West would have lost a very important friend.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard on the ground in Amman, Jordan for us this week. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
When Michelle Obama makes the media circuit tomorrow to mark the first anniversary of her campaign against childhood obesity, there will be stories about that issue, of course, but also some commentary on what she's wearing. A First Lady's sense of style has been noteworthy for as long as there have been First Ladies. And in her new book, Everyday Icon, fashion writer Kate Betts says that's especially true for Michelle Obama.
She wears a lot of flats. She wears a lot of pants with blouses and belted cardigans over them. She wears these very sort of feminine and fun printed, floral printed dresses.
Or as you say, you call it approachable at one point in this book. And I'm going to quote a friend of yours. You got an exchange from her at one point. Mrs. Obama had been seen in a sort of an informal dress or something. And this friend of yours wrote to you and said, you know what, I don't want my first ladies to be approachable.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, the first lady has such an historic place, obviously, in this country. And I was talking with a great historian who's written a lot about Dolly Madison, Catherine Algor, and she said, you know, we want our first lady to look good, but not too good.
Yeah.
Because some people do like the pomp and circumstance and the sort of formality that comes with that kind of position. But I think that a lot of women today can relate more easily to somebody like Michelle Obama as a casual, very everyday icon.
Do you see that being reflected in fashion trends and in style trends?
Oh, absolutely. Her use of color, the way she wears such beautiful colors so easily. Designers for spring have completely embraced that idea, and you see color all over the runways. The flat shoes, we're seeing heel heights go down for the first time in several seasons. And so I think that designers definitely take note. I mean, as Narciso Rodriguez says
remind
to me
us
in the
all,
book,
especially me, who Narciso Rodriguez is.
Narciso Rodriguez is a designer, and he has dressed Michelle Obama on several occasions. And he said, you know, such a huge force in fashion ultimately becomes fashion. And I think that's true.
There are those who will listen to this interview and hear that it's about style and fashion and clothes and kind of dismiss it as not substantive.
For some reason in this country, there is this false notion that style and substance should occupy two separate planets, really. And I think that actually Michelle Obama is proof, living proof, that you can be stylish and substantive and you don't have to make excuses for one or the other.
There is the Nancy Reagan problem, too. She wore a lot of high-end gowns, was really criticized for it at a time when the economy was kind of in the tank in the early Reagan administration. I mean, there's that little bit that Michelle Obama, I would imagine, has to defend against a little bit.
Yes, and she has been, from the early days of the campaign, very clever about wearing brands like J. Crew and Target and H&M and The Gap. I mean, one of my favorite moments was when she wore a Gap sweater that I don't think could have cost more than $49 to lunch with Nancy Reagan.
Yeah. You touch on this a little bit kind of at the end of the book, but I wanted to get your thoughts on how important it is for the world of style and fashion that Michelle Obama is African American.
I think it's incredibly important. I think that's what makes her iconic, is that she is the first African-American first lady. And I think that that's why people are really looking to her to see what she does and to see how she carries herself and how she handles the whole style part of the equation of the first lady position. She's incredibly influential, particularly to African-American women, young women. They see her as their maybe the first style icon they've ever known.
Kate Betts, her book about Michelle Obama is called Everyday Icon, Michelle Obama and the Power of Style. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There are pictures and a lot more First Lady fashion factoids on our website, marketplace.org/thebigbook. If you want to get something done in Washington, you pretty much have to hire somebody there to make your case, to hang around Capitol Hill and lobby. And there is a little something for everybody. There is a registered lobbyist for UFO believers, the American League of Lobbyists, and I love this one, Lobbies for Lobbyists. And there is the National Cannabis Industry Association, which is more straight-laced than you might think. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
Steve Fox is the picture of establishment Washington. His dark hair is cut short with a little gray at the temples. He's wearing a dark green suit, white shirt, and tie. His shiny brown shoes carry him briskly through the lobby of a Senate office building. Fox is all business as the chief lobbyist for the National Cannabis Industry Association.
There's a lot going on.
Fox takes me to one of his favorite haunts, a cafe tucked into a corner of the building. He explains this is a joint effort by growers and sellers to promote pot on Capitol Hill.
I simply believe it's wrong that the government uses its power to punish individuals who just want to relax and use cannabis.
Fox used to work for medical marijuana user groups. Their focus was on individual rights. Now he switched to representing the medical marijuana business.
Being in Washington, it's no secret that money talks. We are small businesses. We are creating jobs. We are generating tax revenues. And we need to have our voice heard.
Fox's group turned to Congressman Barney Frank. The Massachusetts Democrat has unsuccessfully introduced at least 4 bills over the years in support of medical marijuana. This year, he's trying something new, legislation that would decriminalize marijuana nationwide. That would clear up confusion in the 15 states that have legalized medical marijuana. Frank says it's wrong for the feds to ignore states' decisions on the issue.
I don't see why the federal government say, oh, yeah, but you may say that, but we're going to have the FBI come in and get you.
Fox knows the prospects for Frank's legislation are grim, but he says at least he can call attention to the issue. Republican Congressman Wally Herger of California is paying plenty of attention. His opinion of Frank's bills?
I don't think you'll find very much support for that. And certainly I, with the experience I have in my area, would be very strongly an opponent of that.
Herger introduced a resolution cracking down on the cultivation of cannabis on federal land. It passed by a vote of 400-4. And that was in December, before the Republicans took over the House. Back at the cafe, Fox says he's also lobbying the Obama administration, trying to change how it enforces federal law. Take money laundering. Fox says right now it's hard for growers in states that have legalized medical marijuana to set up bank accounts because banks are afraid of violating federal money laundering laws.
We have some people who are driving around the state of Colorado with tens of thousands of dollars in cash because they can't find a bank to work with them in their area.
Fox says the Treasury Department could tell banks not to worry about growers in states that have legalized medical marijuana. If Fox can get a couple bank accounts open, he'll consider that a major victory. Knowing battles over the big questions like legalization will take years. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a shout-out to the cinephiles among you who clearly know their Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid better than I do. The scene I mentioned yesterday in my interview about the Huffington Post AOL deal, the bit where Butch and Sundance go jumping off that cliff.
I'll jump first. No. Then you jump first.
No, I said.
What's the matter with you?
I can't swim!
All right, so that was the middle of the movie, not the end. Also, no Bolivian army at that point either. So consider this a correction for the record. Still, pretty good movie, though, huh? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pumped up 71 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ climbed 13 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.4%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you can tune tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here in Jordan, opportunity is all about who you know.
The corruption really covers all aspects of life, which left people who don't belong to this class helpless.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.